From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
She spent more than 40 years desperately trying to reconcile her faith with her sexuality, turning to her church for gay conversion therapy in her 20s.
I really believe that God would heal me.
You were involved in exorcisms.
Yes, plenty of exorcisms. People would pray for me and I would find myself gagging or choking. A couple of times I was violently sick.
Did you feel you could be gay and religious?
But at the time, it felt like a death sentence.
If there is a high-profile discussion, hearing, debate, or interview about conversion therapy in the UK, it's more than likely that Jane Ozan will be included. A high-profile, dedicated activist, the founder of the Ozan Foundation, is a survivor of ex-gay manipulation as well as religious trauma herself, and her empathy and anger are bound in equal measure. This week, we'll take a look at the status of this abuse, always shrouded in religious language and privilege, in Great Britain.
People don't remember that one of the reasons it became legal was so it could be done cleanly.
Right.
And you could go someplace which wasn't a back alley. That was the whole point.
We have never been so close to having Roe v. Wade nullified as we are today. And should the Supreme Court reverse that momentous 1973 decision, more than half the states are ready to ban a woman's right to choose outright. But wait, there's more. Writing in Religion Dispatches magazine, Ryan Stoller argues that overturning Roe v. Wade may endanger this cherished evangelical practice. We'll find out what exactly that cherished practice is when Ryan joins me later in the hour.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and this huge empty space where common human decency used to be. Yet another American Catholic bishop has sold his soul to partisanship, betraying anything resembling Christianity. Apparently outraged that his brother bishops recently ended up not calling for withholding sacraments from politicians who do not toe the church line on matters of abortion, John Dorfler of Marquette, Illinois, says transgender Catholics, non-binary Catholics, Catholics in same-sex relationships, and probably Catholics who take his parking space, none of them are to receive the sacraments, including baptism, communion, and anointing of the sick. This, of course, directly contradicts clear direction from Pope Francis himself, but today's rabid right wing, no matter their religion nor respected status, always shows its true colors in the end. Pretty much every modern and not-so-modern country offers emergency contraception care in the form of a pill these days. Countless rape victims, the condom-broke types, and others in urgent need of a safe and effective Plan B have benefited. But the same extremist political religious right in this country, also known as the forced pregnancy crowd, is up in arms over President Biden's nominee to head up the FDA because, wait for it, he supports the morning-after pill. He even dares, gasp, want more people to have access. So let me get this straight. The same purportedly pro-lifers who want the cutoff for pregnant women's access to reproductive health care to fall before pregnancy can even be reliably confirmed also want to deny women a way to avoid that circumstance altogether. And if the well-known saying, history is written by victors, is true, then the culture wars seem to have some definite winners right around now. Texas Freedom Network reports that the latest batch of history books destined for use in Texas public school history classrooms and those in a number of smaller states that rely on Texan academic materials include texts attributing the founding of our nation to Moses, attributing international terrorism to only Islam, and virtually ignoring all religions save Christianity in describing America today. I could go on about the focus on states' rights instead of slavery as the catalyst for the Civil War and so forth, but you'll be helping your kids with their homework soon enough, and you'll hear all this direct firsthand anyway. Happy holidays, everyone!
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Jane Ozanne is a leading campaigner for the rights and dignity of LGBTQI plus persons in the UK and beyond. Having spent decades struggling with the condemnation by the faith she cherished of the love she craved, Jane turned the life-threatening denial and deprivation she subjected herself to into tireless activism, writing, public speaking, and in 2018, the Ozanne Foundation. As the holidays bring families together across America and actually across the world, this can be a time of particular struggle for millions of LGBTQ persons who will again endure hearing condemning words from the people they love the most, either generally or worse, directly aimed at them. That's why I wanted to amplify Jane's voice on our program this week, both because her story is so inspiring, but also because the warning implicit in that story is so very urgent. So with all of that said, Jane Ozanne, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilson.
You identify as an evangelical within the Anglican Church. What tradition would that align with in the United States?
Well, the Church of England is part of the Anglican Communion, which the Episcopal Church of the United States, with the presiding bishop Michael Curry, is also part of. But as an evangelical, I suppose I also have quite a lot of links with a lot of the evangelical movements. I used to be very involved with a lot of the evangelical churches in Washington and further afield. But obviously that's where a lot of my struggle lay, because typical evangelical thinking, not all, I'm glad to say that there is an increasing movement of what we call accepting evangelicals right across the globe now. Yeah. But traditionally, it is the evangelical churches that often have a significant problem with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer. In fact, anybody who doesn't define as, quote, heterosexual normative.
Yeah. Here in America, a powerful alliance of evangelical and Catholic leaders have been leading, I just have to say, a brutal anti-LGBTQI plus theology, defying both science and even defying Pope Francis and powerfully impacting government policies. Explain, if you would, how influential homophobic religion is in your country, if you would.
Well, you're right. The right wing, Christian, primarily evangelical, but not just evangelical influences in the UK are strong within the Tory party, the Conservative Party, led by Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister. And that has impacted various debates from assisted dying, abortion, and indeed, obviously, this current debate around conversion therapy, where many evangelical Christian leaders are campaigning for the right to continue to be able to pray the gay or indeed the trans away. They feel that it's their God-given duty to do that, independent of all the evidence of the harm that that does, all the testimonies from survivors of the harm that they have endured, all the medical opinion that clearly states the impact, the psychological impact, let alone often the physical impact on individuals, leaves lifelong trauma and scars. And for me, this has got to a point now where I think the harm that these supposed Christians do needs clearly calling out. You know, it's a spirit that Jesus confronted, I believed, in his day, when he had to take on religious leaders who seemed to believe they knew the law better than Jesus did, but did not see the person who they were hurting right in front of them.
Yeah.
And Jesus had a lot to say to them, and that is what I think it's about time we started saying, indeed I have been saying now, to evangelicals both in the UK and further across the field. You know, I believe in what I call good disagreement, that we have to respect each other, we need to see the Christ in each other. But there comes a point where reasoned argument, appealing to pastoral principles, looking at shared gospel, doesn't seem to cut it. And we actually need to say enough.
Yeah.
When young people, and they are particularly young people, as lives are at risk, we know that the attempted suicide rate, and indeed even sadly, completed suicide rate amongst young LGBT people, particularly those from a religious background, is exceptionally high. The level of homelessness around particularly young LGBT people is 3 times the national average. You know, these are statistics that have their roots often in the religious cultural backgrounds that they've had to flee.
Yeah.
And we need our hearts should be breaking, frankly, as a nation over this, and calling people out to account, because it's homophobic teaching is not biblical in my mind.
Yeah.
It is not godly. And as Archbishop Desmond Tutu himself said, you know, God is not homophobic. And if he is, I don't want to go there, you know.
Yeah.
So, I feel very angry at the willful ignorance and the willful determination not to engage with the evidence and the harm that's being caused right now.
I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is UK LGBTQI+ faith activist Jane Ozan. May I ask you to briefly describe your own journey? Because it is both painfully relatable for a lot of people, but also remarkable in that you didn't walk away from religion, but instead you've dedicated yourself to creating life-saving change.
Thank you, Wilson. I'd happily do that. And there, I have a book called Just Love, which goes into my story in a lot more depth. I think, you know, I'll try and praise it quickly. But I grew up in a Christian home. I come from Guernsey in the Channel Islands. Ozan is a Guernsey name, a little island, quite a conservative community. I'm in my 50s now. And growing up, I had no idea, if I'm honest, that women could be gay. I knew men could be. They were often the subject of ridicule on television programs. But there was no obvious role model or indeed understanding. And so when in my 20s, having spent most of my teenage years and early 20s, you know, hoping and praying that God would send me a knight in shining armor, that one day, you know, the lights would dim and the music would swell and I'd see this wonderful man across the room who I'd fall madly in love with, that never seemed to happen. But instead, what happened was I found myself falling madly in love, heaven forbid, with a woman that I was working with. And I had nowhere to go with that horror. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I thought that I would be rejected immediately or put on what I call the theological naughty step, someone who would be seen as terribly unsound. And I thought that I brought this on myself. I thought it was the devil trying to tempt me off course, if you like. I had a very strong, fervent faith at that young age. And I spent years, frankly, begging God to change me, fasting, praying, doing anything I could privately, but carrying this terrible secret and believing I was the only one who'd ever gone through this sort of thing. And that stress took me to a very difficult and dark place. I had a very successful career. I was working with Procter & Gamble, and then I'd worked with Kimberly Clark, taking them into Eastern Europe, and I was then the head of marketing at the BBC. So, you know, extremely important, dare I say, key jobs, but this terrible secret that crushed me, and I ended up in hospital with my body, frankly, cracking under the strain. a full-blown breakdown. And I knew what the problem was. And indeed, I started talking to my therapist and explained that I had this terrible dilemma between my faith and my sexuality. And she looked at me and told me to change my faith, which frankly was the worst thing she could have possibly said, because that meant I never spoke to her again either. I thought, you just don't get this. But I then did start reaching out to people in my church, asking them to pray. I went to various healing conferences. We all believed, and the current belief was that it was something that must have happened to me, a relationship with one of my parents. I've been very open in the UK here on in public news about the fact that sadly I'd been raped by a priest. And of course, everybody thought, well, that's why, Jane. And so I would constantly have to relive that trauma and get people to pray into that, believing that God would answer our prayers. And of course, when those prayers didn't work, you're left being told that you are the problem, mm-hmm. that there is something that's meaning that you must be ungodly, or you're not being open enough, or you don't have enough faith. And the problem is always left at your door. Plus the fact you're feeling an abomination and sinful, that the devil's got a hold of you. And to have that weight on your shoulders, in my case, for years upon years upon years, when you're trying to be a good Christian witness, I had a calling. I was now in a very senior place within the Church of England. I was on the Archbishop's Council, which meant that I was one of the most senior lay people in the Church of England, a voluntary role. I didn't dare tell anybody that I was going through all this. And then I reached out for more specific ministries, deliverance ministries, exorcisms, anyone who could help me. I went around the world. I suppose I was speaking actually as a senior evangelical around the world, and I would ask people to pray for me then. And I went through periods where I truly thought it had worked. And I think ultimately I was just completely shut down. And then in 2006, I moved to Oxford. I was doing a course for diplomats in Oxford. And I fell madly in love again, unrequited as usual. But I realized that all those years of prayer had not worked. And that sent me to a very dark place. And again, my body started to crack under the strain. I ended up back in hospital and another full-blown breakdown, where I felt the only way out was to consider taking my life.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I knew somehow that God wanted more for me than that. And I realized in my spirit that God would know that I had tried everything I possibly could, and somehow I would have to embrace who I was. I felt that was the only way out of this. And I thought I'd be walking away from my faith. I started dating a lovely lady who I was to be with for years, and I fell madly in love, and that brought me alive. And I think anybody knowing me could see the change overnight. But the biggest thing for me was that I found my God walking with me, you know, the same way that I commune with God, if you like, and I hear that still small voice, that presence that directs my path, was still very much with me. And I knew that at some point I would have to re-engage with the church and with this debate. Once I'd healed, it took a few years, I have to be honest, to get over the bruising of coming out as a senior evangelical. I lost most of my friends overnight, and you know, it caused a lot of problems. But in 2014, I started to re-engage. Here we are, all those years later.
Okay. Your work today focuses now a lot on ending conversion therapy. On this show, we've affirmed many times that this is not therapy at all, that it is, in fact, torture. But many people imagine that gay people are forced into that kind of manipulation when, in fact, it is so often something that people seek out voluntarily. But it's, but it's not really voluntarily, is it?
Well, I mean, you're right. I sought it out willingly. I was desperate for any cure or healing prayer, because I wanted to, quote, live what I was taught and told would be the godly life. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to marry and have children and all the things that I saw as, quote, normal, in inverted commas. And I thought that that's what God wanted for me too. And everyone around me thought that. And everyone around me wanted the same thing for me. They wanted my healing. So if you like, I was in a bubble of coercion where everyone, to not agree that, to go against that, would have cost and did cost me so much that it wasn't really a choice. And so what we call coercive control is really at work in these hermeneutically sealed bubbles. Yeah. And the harm that then I did to myself, my body literally cracking and getting to that point of suicide because I could see no way out. That is so common. And that's what makes me so angry, because mm-hmm. these Christian leaders who encourage people as they did me down this path know far too often of the implications of what they're telling mm-hmm. people. They know far too often the breakdowns, the suicide attempts, the people that they never see or hear of again. But they're so determined that they think they're doing God's work because they have such a what I call kindergarten approach to theology. They haven't really gone back and looked at the Greek and the Hebrew of what the Bible really says about these things. They haven't truly understood that it's unconditional love is unconditional, and that the whole purpose of the Christian faith is about what Christ has done for us, not what we do for Christ. I don't know. I just think the theology is so wrong. But that's a different issue. For me right now, the important thing is to safeguard LGBT people in religious spaces, independent of what someone's theology should be. LGBT people should be as free to be safe mm-hmm. as any other member of the community. And that's why I and others are focusing on the need to ban conversion therapy, because this is about the well-being of LGBT people.
You know, I think there is an incredible amount of ignorance on the part of heterosexual persons regarding how difficult, frightening, and isolating coming to terms with one's non-mainstream sexuality still is. But that's where the vulnerability comes from, that churches can take advantage of it. What is the process the Anglican Church is engaged in right now around ex-gay therapy?
Well, in 2017, I led a debate in our General Synod. That's our Church of England's parliament, if you like, the place where we make decisions for the church. And I had what we call a private members motion. So anybody can bring forward a motion. They need to get over 100 people to agree, but they want to debate it. But my motion was to condemn conversion therapy publicly. And we had quite a debate on it. Fortunately, the bishops got completely behind it. And indeed, somebody asked for an amendment which was passed and fully supported by the archbishops and bishops, where we called on the government to ban it. And so the Church of England itself, which is made up of what we call evangelicals and Catholics and liberals, we're a broad church in the Church of England, sends a very clear message to the British government that they wanted conversion therapy banned. And since then, the Methodist Church in the UK has also passed a similar motion, the Quakers, the Hindu Council, the Buddhist Dharma Centre, there's all sorts of religious leaders now have backed this call for a ban, because they know how damaging it is and how religion often, sadly, has been to blame. Religion isn't the only form of conversion practices. And you're quite right earlier, it's no therapy at all. I'm trying to get people to use the phrase conversion practice, because I think therapy puts it in a medical setting and it's far from therapeutic. The vast majority of conversion practices in the UK happen in a religious setting. And that's why it's been so important that religious leaders themselves have called and backed this ban.
I understand the government of the UK has also been looking into ex-gay quackery, I guess you'd call it. What's the status of that?
Well, there are some who believe that, as I did for a period, that they, you know, they've, quote, been healed, or that they have to live a celibate life, or that they need to marry someone of the opposite sex and fake it to make it, as it were. Now, all that leads to horrendous damage. They're not living a true and honest life. And I find it inconceivable that it's religious leaders who are advocating this, because it's living a lie. And it's a suppressing part of our God-given nature. And that, we know, causes huge trauma with lifelong scarring for people. And young, you know, I know of, sadly, one young person who took their life because they believed that they would never know love, they'd never know intimacy, they'd never have a family. And they found that burden crushing. Mm-hmm. And I, as you said earlier, I don't believe that many heterosexual people understand at all what they're asking of their LGBT colleagues by telling them that they have to be abstinent for life. Mm-hmm. It's not something that they would contemplate. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I make the parallel with what Jesus said to the Pharisees when he talks about them putting burdens on their back that they have no intent of helping people to live. I think the problem is so often that, dare I say it, that certain evangelicals assume that LGBT people are degenerate or an abomination. They represent the devil, and they don't see us as human beings. They don't see us as people who have flesh, who God's image is in. And it is that I think we have to tackle, because that is the worst kind of theology, when you stop seeing a human being as a child of God. Mm-hmm.
There's still more with Jane Ozanne coming right up. And later, Ryan Stoller. He's analyzing the slippery slope of disappearing rights after Roe v. Wade goes away. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Jane, it's a holiday season. It can be a very triggering time for LGBTQI plus persons, especially young people, to be in settings that they grew up in and with people who do not respect them. What are some coping strategies you could suggest for people?
Oh, my heart goes out to people. I know that, you know, so often we have this wonderful, cozy, happy family image portrayed to us through the media, and for so many people's lived experiences, far from that. The wonderful thing these days, though, is we do have the internet and we do have communities online. We have safe spaces, be it on Facebook or in support groups, where you can reach out and know that you are not alone. And for me, the most important thing anybody facing that, what they know might be a difficult place, is they go into it knowing that they are not alone, that there are others who understand, perhaps not exactly their pain, but understand that situation. So do try and link up with a friend who you can call or WhatsApp, or a Facebook group, or a, you know, find people that you admire, and then look at where they congregate, because having people walking alongside you is so important. And if you're a person of faith, you know, that's where you have to dig deep and ask God to intervene too, that there might be a surprising word of encouragement, a surprising act of love. Look around you. Don't anticipate that everyone around you is in the same box. What I've learned so often is that, you know, we are all, most people are on a journey towards inclusion, aren't they? And people often are privately inclusive ahead of being able to say that publicly. Mm-hmm. But by our witness, by being our true, authentic selves. We often speak into people's hearts and minds in a way that we don't know. So don't assume everybody's against you, because more often than not, you'll find there's some wonderful allies in the most surprising of places. Try and just speak your heart is my final piece of advice. You know, say when it's hurting, if it's safe to do so. It's not always safe, but people need to see you as human.
I really want to take you to the other side of that and ask you, what would you say to parents and others who may be uncomfortable with the situation? Why is it important to love unconditionally rather than fall into patterns of judgment and criticism?
Because that's what Jesus does, isn't it? Jesus just loves. No strings, no, you know, caveats, no exclusion clauses. You know, God is bigger than all these problems. And I think, you know, if you struggle to understand the choices that your children make, ask God to care for them, but don't, you know, your role is to love them and let God do the rest. And maybe the only person we can ever change is ourselves. And being open to the transforming power of the Holy Spirit, if you're a Christian, I think is, and keeping ourselves open and not assuming that we know all the answers. But I think the job of a parent, the most beautiful gift you have of a child, is to love unconditionally, as difficult as you may find that, and trust that God, who loves your child just as much as you do, if not more, will care and show them the way.
Jane, you've been through so much. It has made you an incredibly effective advocate and organizer. But at such a profound personal cost, if you could say one thing to your younger self, knowing what you know now, what would you say?
That you are lovable and that you are loved. You know, for so many years, I didn't believe that. I believed that I had to become something else to be lovable, that I thought I was an abomination. And even now, when I'm single now, I've not found the right woman, sadly. And I think a lot of that is because of my own levels of self-hatred and self-internalized homophobia. I've had to learn that I'm lovable and that I am loved. And that most importantly is that God never, ever lets us go. And I think for me, I know this isn't quite what you asked, but one of the turning points in my life was when I went from dealing with God as someone who I was slightly scared of, who I felt I ought or I should behave in a certain way, to dealing with God in my real raw state and losing my temper and saying how I felt. And that level of real engagement with my with God was what transformed my life. And I think, and I urge others to get honest and real, both with God and then with themselves, and to see the truth that is in front of them. One of the moments in this long journey that stands out for me more than anything was my aunt called me a week after I'd come out. And it had been a very difficult week for me because, let's just say, not all the family had responded too well. And I saw her call coming through on my call phone, and I nearly didn't take it. But in the end, I thought, well, I can't avoid it forever, ever. And I answered, and she said, "Darling, I'm just ringing to apologise." And I went, "Apologise, Auntie Sue? What on earth for?" And she said, "Darling, we always knew. We just never had the courage to tell you." And I remember feeling this whole wave of emotion, from anger that she hadn't told me, to relief, to love, to, gosh, the whole multi. But, you know, we always knew. And deep down, many of your listeners know that their children are gay. Many of you know that your neighbour is. But we don't want to admit it or talk about it because we don't know how. And it's that silence that can be so crushing. So So I think if there's one thing I would encourage people to do or find a way to do is to break that silence and to reach out and to love, because that can be a lifeline, quite literally, for so many who feel they are unlovable and unloved at this time of year.
Jane, I want our listeners to know about the foundation that you have. Would you tell our listeners how they can support you and stay informed on what you're doing?
Thank you. So I have an unusual name, Ozanne, O-Z-A-N-N-E. And my foundation is www.ozanne.foundation. On there, you'll find links to all my work. But importantly, on the contact page, you'll be able to sign up to my newsletter if you'd like that, and how you can support us financially. I work with religious leaders, senior religious leaders around the world to tackle discrimination and prejudice. You know, in 2019, I had the great honor of meeting His Holiness. I work with archbishops and members from across all the faiths. And last year, we launched the Global Interfaith Commission on LGBT Lives. And that website is globalinterfaith.lgbt. And that's brought together hundreds of religious leaders, senior religious leaders around the world who want to celebrate and affirm the LGBT community. And if you're interested in that, you can go on the website and see the work we do there. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter or on Facebook. I have an unusual name. Luckily, there's only one of me, Jane with a Y, Ozanne. And I'd love to hear from people.
Jane Ozanne is a leading LGBTQ plus evangelical activist in the UK, the founder of the Ozanne Foundation. She is the author of Just Love, A Journey of Self-Acceptance. Jane, happy holidays to you. I can't thank you enough for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, and happy holidays to you and all your listeners, too.
We were fortunate to have Ryan Stoller with us once before, and when his recent Religion Dispatches article appeared, I knew we needed to have him with us once again. The piece is headlined, Unintended Consequences Overturning Roe v. Wade May Endanger the Cherished Evangelical Practice. And I am happy to have the author with us today. Ryan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me again.
As if creating a free-for-all around reproductive rights weren't bad enough, what else do you envision happening in the aftermath of the High Court striking down Roe?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ramifications that come from overturning Roe. And what I focus on in my article the most is the issue of family privacy rights. You know, Roe is obviously about reproductive rights, but those rights were grounded by the court in the idea of privacy. And privacy has served to protect all sorts of different rights in addition to reproductive ones. And some of those include like the right to homeschool your child or provide your child a religious education. That's what I focus on in my article the most. But there's also a bunch of different other consequences that could happen as well. You know, the right to use birth control, the right to marry who you want, regardless of their race or sex, the right to have, you know, a relationship with another person. All these different rights are grounded in family privacy, which is what Roe protects.
Your expertise is in the area of homeschooling, particularly under the auspices of religion. Talk some more, please, about the cornerstone value of privacy that the religious right has benefited from so much since 1973.
Yeah, homeschooling and religious schooling both are grounded in this idea that the family has the right to privacy. They have the right to make choices about how they want to raise their children, how they want to educate their children. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly affirmed in many different cases throughout the United States history that parents indeed have those rights. And they are specifically, you know, they're not mentioned in the Constitution. Nowhere in the Constitution does it mention that the idea of parental rights or family rights. And so the court has regularly grounded those rights in this idea of privacy, which came from Roe and then several other court cases before it, like Griswold versus Connecticut, which was about the right to use birth control. And then there's also Meyer versus Nebraska, which is about the right to teach your child in the way that you see that is most appropriate.
Mm-hmm. In addition to homeschooling, what are the other major rulings involving privacy that came after Roe that would be undermined?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. I gave a list in my article for people that are listening that want to see all the different ones that are related to Roe. You can check that out. Just to list a few, we have Lawrence versus Texas, which struck down laws that were prohibiting same-sex relationships. And then you also have Obergefell, which legalized marriage equality in the United States. Both of those are grounded in the rights to privacy that we have enshrined because of Roe.
We have seen the same voices raised in condemning privacy rights when involved in consensual same-sex activity that praise privacy when it serves their own agenda. Mm-hmm. What reason do we have to expect the epic hypocrisy to stop now?
That's a great question. I don't think that we're going to see that hypocrisy stop. I think that, the evangelical right is very inconsistent in how they approach, jurisprudence in the United States. I think that they are very interested in protecting privacy rights when those rights serve their own purposes, which are often related to, advancing a Christian nationalist, Christo-fascist perspective in the United States, this idea that we need to take back the United States for God's glory and return it to its Christian foundations. And so anytime that privacy can serve those purposes, you're going to see evangelicals be all about it. But at the same time, they don't want those rights to be applied to anyone outside of their circles. They think that the right to family privacy is not something that, queer families should be able to have the right to, or a lot of, families of color. The evangelical right sees anyone that deviates from their norms as evil. And so that automatically excludes those families from the ability to participate in this right to privacy that they have constitutionally.
Mm-hmm. The numerous losses in terms of privacy and other rights, with all of that going about, and you've put them all out there, why is there not more conversation about those losses?
I think that there's not a lot of knowledge about what will be lost with the overturning of Roe. I think that the evangelicals have focused so exclusively on this idea that, abortion is mass genocide or a new Holocaust, that there's so much energy and passion and worry that's wrapped up in that issue that people aren't looking to see what are the broader implications when we break open this sphere of family privacy that Roe has protected for so long. People don't realize that Roe is about a lot more than reproductive rights. It's about a lot more than abortion. They don't understand that it's served as this cornerstone to all these different other rights that we take for granted nowadays.
Well, you rightly say evangelicals should be thinking about these issues. But my question is, are they thinking about these issues? Or is it really a matter of kill Roe and then manipulate the outcome with the benefit of a compliant Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's really the second one. I think that they are going for, you know, killing Roe first and then figuring out the ramifications after the fact. But they also haven't been, you know, quiet or withdrawn regarding the fact that Roe has served to protect a lot of other rights. You know, a lot of evangelicals and homeschool advocates have talked. I mentioned this in my article. You know, there's the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, which is the main lobbying organization for homeschoolers in the United States. And several of their attorneys have specifically stated that Roe is the strongest precedent for the right to teach your children at home. And yeah, they just don't make a big deal out of that. So there no one's talking in the evangelical circles about the fact that Roe really does protect the right to teach your children how you see as appropriate. And so without the leaders and the people with influence talking about it, the average homeschooler or average evangelical just has no idea that this could actually impact them in other ways other than ending abortion, keeping it, you know, on the back burner in terms of priorities.
You know evangelicals well, and when we're saying that they really are not thinking about these issues, could you just say, because you do know evangelicals, what is one of the most important rights that they claim that could be lost in what's going to happen?
Well, what they could lose is the right to teach their children at home, or the right to give their children a religious education. You know, if families don't have the right to have privacy in how they choose to raise their children, if we crack that, you know, that protected sphere open, you know, it's going to be Pandora's box. It's going to be, you know, a brave new world in terms of what the government can regulate. And, you know, evangelicals have been fighting for decades fiercely for this idea that, you know, the government has no right or no say to get involved in how they choose to raise their children. And if we're allowing the government in now to make decisions between families and their doctors, why not families and their teachers, families and their parents? You know, any of that is now fair game. And so I really think evangelicals should be concerned about what could happen once we allow Roe's protections to disappear.
So ultimately, how do you see this play out? Because if this case doesn't end Roe, there are other cases waiting in line to continue the assault.
Well, the way I see it playing out is more in terms of impacting homeschoolers who are not evangelicals. You know, I think that the Supreme Court is, you know, it's pretty heavily conservative now. So if, you know, Roe is overturned and then homeschooling becomes this contested, controversial, you know, in terms of the Constitution, contested practice, I think this Supreme Court, the way it's made up, could easily find, you know, loopholes or alternative precedents to allowing evangelicals to homeschool their children. But the real catch, I think, is going to be homeschoolers who don't fit that mold. So progressive homeschoolers or Catholic homeschoolers, Muslim homeschoolers, I think they're going to be the ones that end up feeling most the weight of overturning this right to privacy. But I do think it'll also be something that, you know, as the government starts creeping into these different areas where they're previously prohibited from, you're going to start creating court precedents, and those precedents will eventually get around to impacting even the evangelical homeschoolers. Mm. And that's something that I see from studying the evangelical right for a long time, where they, you know, they are often opportunists. They're not thinking about, you know, consistency in court cases. And so they seize these opportunities, and then they create unintended consequences that come around to bite them, and they're counterproductive in the end.
Ryan L. Stoller is a child liberation theologian and an advocate for children and abused survivors, the author of an upcoming book on child liberation theology, The Kingdom of Children. Ryan is the co-founder of the viral website Homeschoolers Anonymous. Ryan, happy holidays to you, and you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, and happy holidays to you as well.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, a person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.